There we go. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Narkees, the 23rd of September, 2017. And we have some very interesting texts this morning. So, glad you all made it. I'm on the board with Leviticus 11. That's our chapter today. And we've been following the triennial parasha. So this section of Leviticus has been linked way back in Jesus' time to Isaiah 40, verses 16 and following. And so we're going to read both these passages, and we're going to think about why they connected these two passages. And if you guys were reading through the Bible in the synagogue, you got to Leviticus 11, as you'll see in a second, it would be very difficult to think of what could possibly be connected to Leviticus 11. A challenge. And so just imagine you're sitting there reading all this stuff and you have no concordance, and someone calls on you to pick a section of the prophets that would complement Leviticus 11. And so I think we'll see, it's kind of amazing that they came up with Isaiah 40. As we've seen already reading through all of these portions of the text, many prophetic sections are from Isaiah. So that's also another interesting thing. Isaiah is one of the dominant prophetic voices you get, really.
So you're saying when they choose a verse that complements, this is before there were set verses? Or
yes.
Okay.
The triennial parasha we're following is a compilation taken from the Cairo Geniza and some other sources that basically there were popular things. Just like you've heard passages and we've all heard popular sermons preached on the same passage.
Yeah.
So it's like it became popular to read certain sections together because
of
the word links.
So eventually
they become systematized. But in Jesus' day, there was still some fluidity, and that's why we have in the Nazareth synagogue, they hand him the scroll and say,
read
something. And so he had a little bit amount of
leverage.
Yeah, he could decide where to read from. I mean, from the scroll of Isaiah, but and so he chose a section.
It was more charismatic that way.
Maybe more charismatic, but also your average person in the audience, I mean, they're making these connections based on words. And it's amazing because you really have to have the whole Torah internalized and really most of the prophets to be able to connect the two things.
Everyone in the audience knows the Bible so well, they're like, oh, I thought he might go there.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I would imagine, like in any community, you wouldn't just choose anybody. You choose the people you think might make good connections.
The Holy Spirit's got something to do with it. Today I was
doing
something and I was preparing. And I said, right, now I hadn't looked up the Haftarah at all. And I said, right, it's Joel 2. Let's look at Joel 2. Shout, sound the trumpet in Zion. And blow me when I looked at the bit of paper, it says Joel 2. So I think that was the Lord. And in the same way, I think it must have been happening then.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. And it's a nice discipline to be reading this chapter today because it's one of those chapters that unless you intentionally read it, you never will. You know, as we'll see as we read through it. So let's do it. Gemma, if you'd start us out, our tradition around this table is you just kind of read three or four verses, whatever seems to chunk together. When one person stops, the next person carries on.
Adonai spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying to them, speak to B'nai Israel, saying, these are the living things which you may eat among the animals that are on the earth. Whatever has a split, divided hoof, and chews the cud among the animals, that you may eat. Nevertheless, you shall not eat of those that only chew the cud or have a split hoof. The camel, though it chews the cud, does not have divided hoof, is unclean to you. The coney, though it chews the cud, yet does not have divided hoof, so it's unclean to you. The hare, though it chews the cud, does not split the hoof, so it's unclean to you. The pig, though it has a split divided hoof, does not chew the cud, so it's unclean to you. You are not to eat meat from them, nor are you to touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you.
Of all the creatures living in the water, of the seas and of the streams, you may eat any that have fins and scales. But all creatures in the seas or streams that do not have fins and scales, whether among all the swarming things or among all the other living creatures in the water, you are to detest. And since you are to detest them, you must not eat their meat, and you must detest their carcasses. Anything living in the water that does not have fins and scales is to be detestable to you.
These are the birds who are to detest and not eat, as they are detestable. The eagle, the vulture, the black vulture, the red kite, any kind of black kite, any kind of raven, the horned owl, the screech owl, the gull, any kind of hawk, the little owl, the cormorant, the great owl, the white owl, the desert owl, the osprey, the stork, any kind of heron, the hoopoe, and the bat.
All flying insects that creep on all fours shall be an abomination to you. Yet these you may eat of every flying insect that creeps on all fours, those which have joint legs above their feet, with which they'll eat on the earth. These you may eat, the locust after its kind, the destroying locust after its kind, the cricket after its kind, and the grasshopper after its kind. But all other flying insects which have 4 feet shall be an abomination to you.
You may make yourselves unclean by these. Whoever touches these carcasses will be unclean till evening. Whoever picks up one of their carcasses must wash his clothes, and he will be unclean till evening. Every animal that has a split hoof, not completely divided, or that does not chew the cud, is unclean from you. Whoever touches the carcass of any of them will be unclean. Of all the animals that walk on all fours, those that walk on their paws are unclean for you. Whoever touches their carcasses will be unclean till evening. Anyone who picks up their carcasses must wash his clothes, and he will be unclean till evening. They are unclean for you.
Of the animals that move along the ground, these are unclean for you: the weasel, the rat, and any kind of great lizard. The gecko, the monitor lizard, the wall lizard, the skink, and the chameleon. Of all those that move along the ground, these are unclean for you. Whoever touches them when they are dead will be unclean till evening. One of them dies and falls on something. That article, whatever it is used, will be unclean, whether it is made of wood, cloth, hide, or sackcloth. Put it in water, and it will be unclean till evening, and then it will be clean. If one of them falls into a clay pot, everything in it will be unclean, and you must break the pot. Any food you are allowed to eat that has come in contact with water from such pot is unclean, and any liquid that is drunk from such pot is unclean. Anything that one of their carcasses falls on becomes unclean. An oven or a cooking pot must be broken. They are unclean, and you are to regard them as unclean. A spring, however, or a cistern for collecting water remains clean, but anyone who touches one of these carcasses is unclean. If a carcass falls on any seed that are to be planted, they remain clean. But if water has been put on the seed and the carcass falls on it, then it is unclean for you.
When one of the animals of which you may eat dies, then the one who contacts the carcass shall be unclean till evening. He who eats of the dead body shall wash his clothes and remain unclean until evening. He also who carries the carcass shall wash his clothes and remain unclean till evening.
Sure.
Every creeping thing that crawls on the earth is detestable. It shall not be eaten. Whatever moves on its belly or crawls on all fours or as many feet among all the creeping things that crawl on the earth, these you are not to eat, for they are detestable. You are not to contaminate yourselves with any creeping thing that crawls, nor make yourselves unclean with them or defiled by them. For I am Adonai your God. Therefore sanctify yourselves and be holy. For I am holy. You are not to defile yourselves with any kind of creeping thing that moves on the earth. For I am Adonai, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. Therefore you shall be holy, for I am holy. This is the Torah of the animal, the bird, every living creature that moves in the waters, and every creature that creeps on the earth, to make a distinction between the unclean and the clean, between the living thing that may be eaten and the living thing that may not be eaten.
All right. So
great, isn't it?
It's great. Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure that was all our first thought. This is great. Great stuff. Okay, so we'll stop here before we read the Isaiah 40 and get a better picture. Oh, sorry. Hold on, let me give you something. So here basically we have a list, and Dat Mikra that I was reading about this, a commentator here, pointed out something interesting. Who is this list given to?
Who did?
Well, at the very beginning.
Moses and Aaron.
Because up till now, we've been reading through all these directions that Moses has gotten and then given to Aaron. We have the dedication of the priests. Aaron becomes a priest. We have the whole incident with his kids dying because they didn't follow something exactly enough. And the next thing we're given is this, that God speaks to Moses and Aaron. And who is Aaron?
The priest.
The priest. And so instead of telling Moses to tell Aaron, it's almost like because this is Aaron's whole job, he gets it directly from God. Because as we read through, where was it, in the last chapters, one of the functions of the priest is to tell people what is clean and what is unclean. They have to be the specialists that know the details. This is good, yeah, you can do that, you can't do that.
Like, well,
what about this?
It
has to be
exceptionally perfect in doing it.
Yes, yes. And we had that verse we read, don't defile yourself lest you die. Right? So there is a reverence to these details. That
didn't we read last week about the job of the priest was to teach?
It
that
is to teach.
Very strong.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are with the high priest given a very specific area of teaching.
If you were just to look through the whole Bible, there's several key things. One, only a priest can offer incense. That's like at the top. And we have the instance of King Uzziahu, who tried to take over that position as well, and he got punished with a skin disease for the rest of his life. So that is definitely priests only. Then we have teaching the people. And then a subsection of teaching the people, of course moral teaching, but also teaching them how to be clean and unclean. It's the priest's job. They are supposed to differentiate. Lehavdil, I'm just going to write down here. I'll say, is differentiate a good word?
Distinguish maybe?
Distinguish.
Differentiate. Even separate, because Havdalah is the difference.
Separate, put things in their category. This word, you could translate any of these ways. This is a key word where?
After Shabbat.
When I say Lehavdil, okay, Shabbat, what story first discusses Shabbat?
Creation.
That word is a big word in creation. Every day, God separates between water and water. He separates between light and darkness. He separates between, I don't know, there's a whole list of things. And most people say that it was a priest who wrote down that story. It's using priestly language. And of course, it culminates in the Shabbat, which is set apart. It's separated as holy, and then the rest of the week is normal. When you read the word profane in the Bible, I know I do in English, I get a very negative connotation.
Sure. Isn't it the same word in English?
Profanity.
Profanity.
Profane can never mean anything except negative, I don't think, in English.
In English?
Profane or fame?
What do you think? You get that impression too?
Yeah.
Then it's kind of unfortunate because profane is really just regular. Chol is regular. That means it's non-holy. There's holy that's set apart as something special, and then there's everything else in life. So to be profane isn't a bad thing, it's just normal. It's human, it's everyday, it's casual, and holy is separate and other, and to be respected.
Why do we use the word profane when we translate? That's a very bad... Mm-hmm. Like regular versus special, or...
Yeah, I guess it's been made a term here.
Is coal normal in every context, or it can also be bad, like separate from good?
I don't know of any context. Okay, I'm just speaking off the top of my head. But I can't think of any context where chol is negative.
Where is chol in chapter 11?
Is it the same chol as sand?
It's a homonym. It's not the same, but it's... it's not in chapter 11. I'm just talking about conceptual categories of the priesthood. And along with this distinction, if you're going to make a division between holiness, what's the other side of the coin? So you have holy, and you have what we translate as profane, which is really chol, which just means regular, common, not holy.
Well, it's like our discussion last week about how holy was. That was the word we had a problem with, right?
Okay, so there's two things you differentiate. There's holy, and I'm just going to put regular.
Like it didn't necessarily have anything to do with morality.
Exactly. And then there's... the other ones that are hard to do is clean and unclean. So I'm going to call it ceremonially clean. And then ceremonially unclean. So the clean is tahor, which we sometimes translate pure. And tameh, impure or ceremonially unclean. And this word, Gemma, tameh, is used in this section. One of the words for defiling yourself or to eat an unclean thing is tameh. And when you eat an unclean thing, you defile yourself. And you become tameh.
Right?
No, this is chol. Chol is the noun. Kodesh is holy or holiness, and chol is everything else.
Sharon, by the way, how is that different from the word for sand? Is it with a hey?
No, it's the same spelling, but sometimes what looks like the same root is historically two different roots. It's a homophone.
Okay.
So it sounds the same, but they're two different, originally two different words. Or separate words that sound alike.
Can I ask a question in terms of of what happened with all this concept? Over the years, is that where the legalism of Orthodoxy started, where it, clean and unclean, where it was normal, just ordinary, regular, as opposed to set apart and holy ceremonially,
yeah.
But then everything that wasn't ceremonially clean was despicable, was, you know, profane,
mm-hmm.
was actually quite negative, not normal.
Right.
Today it seems like that.
Well, these two are kind of separate, but there's an overlap. The thing that is similar between the two is that inherently it could be that something could be good by nature, but ceremonially unclean.
Uh-huh. Not despicable and
not despicable.
Or what they call detestable.
And then there are other things that are detestable always. Like, let's say pygmy. Okay, so childbirth would be one of these things that'll make you unclean, but it's considered a blessing. It's a good thing by nature, but it makes you ceremonially unclean. In fact, anything connected to the reproductive system will make you unclean, but it's a good thing. It's a blessing. It's God's first commandment is be fruitful and multiply. So he wouldn't command you to do something that's inherently despicable. But this whole concept of what is appropriate for a holy area in a holy time, that concept is new to us. And we talked about last week, there's nothing, the basic material is the same. Like this chair is made out of wood, plastic, foam, whatever. I can have another chair with the same ingredients, But once that chair has been sanctified for the temple, it is different. If you use it just for anything, you are disrespecting the whole system and thus disrespecting God. So inherently, there's nothing wrong with the chair, but one has been set aside to be holy, one isn't.
It's also a differentiation of purpose. Whenever you talk about chairs, I thought of this last week, is the chair that the godparent sits in for a Brit, for instance, mm-hmm. Elijah's chair or whatever you want to call it. That chair, I mean, you can just sit on the table and sit on a chair, but in many situations you have a chair which is used, I wouldn't call it holy, but it's differentiated. This is what it is. You're certainly not putting a jumble on it while you're waiting for...
And the whole thing is, once you've made it holy, it is holy.
Right.
And then to disrespect it, to just treat it like every other chair, is disrespecting the fact that it's been sanctified.
I think people get muddled up with the word holy. I think it's just been separated for special use. I always think of the
word... Well, because we have connected it so strongly to only moral holiness,
right,
that anything that's unholy must be morally bad. And so we don't have the concept anymore of something being okay, but just not holy.
I always think of the verse at the very end of Zechariah, where I think it's the horses are made holy for the Lord. They're not running around with halos. They've just been separated out.
They've been separated as
out
special.
To be used for the battle or whatever.
Sure.
I'm wondering too, if part of the problem, especially like for Christians, is the fact that we don't like the, and especially in modern times, like we don't like the idea of something being set aside as special if it's not related to holiness or whatever. Like,
if it's not a moral thing.
We want to be much more democratic and egalitarian about that. So to say that a people can still be set aside, that sounds like chauvinism. It sounds like
you're saying they're better than other people.
Right.
Like,
so
no, they're not.
And so we're constantly saying, no, God would only do this because he wanted righteousness. Or he would. So the fact that someone or some people or something is separated to be distinguished, to be set apart as other. If we can't relate morals to it, then that feels wrong. But
offensive.
Yeah, it feels offensive. It feels like, so I, like, it...
That's a good point.
That's a good point. Like it says in Numbers about Israel, I didn't choose you because you were anything special. In fact, you were the smallest
people.
I can't remember the verse.
I chose you to glorify my name.
I've just chosen you for that purpose, that's all.
Yeah. And the whole thing with ceremonially clean and unclean. When I was teaching in New York City, I'd always point out, this can't be sin. To become ceremonially unclean is not a sin. It can't be. Jesus was. Because just being born, you're ceremonially unclean. Because you touch blood of childbirth, which makes you unclean for 7 days.
Right.
So if Jesus is not a sinner, there's no way that that can be a sin. However, to not follow the laws and wash your clothes or bring the sacrifice to restore yourself to cleanliness, that would be a sin because you're ignoring the system that God put in place. So to become unclean, in fact, if you really look at these laws, most of life you live in ceremonial uncleanliness. That's your normal state. So that kind of relates to this regular. That is regular. What isn't regular is being ceremonially clean. So it's kind of opposite to, you can see these Orthodox men today in the bus, they get up if there's a woman sitting next to them. That's all just like, you know.
No, but it does explain the whole concept of the mikveh. You're ceremonially unclean before whatever, and then you go to the mikveh to become ceremonially clean.
Exactly.
That's all it
is. And that's a special state.
That's right.
And then you carefully go to the temple before you become unclean again.
That's right.
Because being unclean is your average state. That's what you are every day of the year, unless you do a mikveh and go up to the temple. And we somehow have it reversed, like most of the time we're over here, and then maybe we'll get contaminated.
Yeah,
it's like, no, most of the time we're here. And then maybe we'll have a special time when we're pure. And that's why you have these special holidays and special, you know, preparations to meet the temple.
Which would be much simpler. You know, you clean up for one event. But it's like, no, but this is every day, all day.
Okay, no, so some of the laws apply to every day, all day.
Jeez.
Sure. But then all you have to do is say, okay, I became unclean. Now I'm unclean till evening. But so is everyone else in the house. And you know, the assumption, if I were living in biblical times, Everyone you meet is unclean. That's your assumption.
That's a lot of laundry.
It's a lot of laundry.
Application, like from the book, None of These Diseases, where these practical laws were actually, when God knew about germs and the people didn't, was a protection from contamination and from getting sick.
There is a practical side, but it's kind of like an overlap, and it's not exhaustive. Because a lot of these laws aren't practical. For instance, we just read about lizards, right? I would be freaked out if I had a lizard in my house, because if that thing dies and falls in the pot of stew I've worked all day making, I have to throw the whole thing out and break the pot. How much money have I just lost if I have a goat stew in there? I've lost a whole goat. I've lost all my time, all that wood I had to gather, the pot I had to make. I mean, it's just horrendous. I'd be freaked out of lizards. Don't get anywhere near, you know. But that same lizard, if it falls, and geckos.
Geckos everywhere.
Yeah.
And they're so cute.
Yeah. They are.
And they fall.
And they're so helpful because they eat cockroaches.
And mosquitoes, they eat mosquitoes.
Yes. Yes. Well, I learned this having a cockroach infestation. One of the ways to deal with it is get a household gecko. But, no, but the point is, so that lizard can contaminate my pot. I have to get rid of it. Now, if that same dead lizard falls in a cistern, what happens?
You can keep it.
You can keep it.
Why? I don't get that. Where have we got to?
I think because...
A proportion of water, maybe it couldn't contaminate the whole thing?
I lost.
Maybe. Maybe, practically speaking, God knew, you can't just get rid of a cistern.
Yeah.
There are limits to what people can do, so it's almost like a built-in exception to the rule.
But
the point, my point is, if the goal of the law was purely hygienic, then it should have been consistent. The water cistern and the pot, they've both been gotten bacteria from the little dead gecko.
Like if we got pneumonia into your dinner and ammonia into the system, you'd shut the lot.
And by evening, he said until evening, and so you'd still be contaminated after evening.
If it boils long enough, right?
And aren't some of these also obviously just to distinguish, just so mm-hmm. that people know that you're different? It's meant to be just on the surface level, like the Nazarite, grow your hair long, don't drink alcohol. It's just purely so that you look different.
So there are two guiding principles, I'd say. One, I like Jacob Milgram's idea that at the root of a lot of these pure, impure idea is really just life and death. And everything that is somehow symbolic of life and purity is in the pure section, and everything that's symbolically connected to death is in the impure section. And I would point out that we raised childbirth, and that the whole reproductive process is in the unclean section, because if you think about it, if you are immortal, you don't need children. Children is part of the mortality system, and therefore, by definition, it's symbolically connected to death, and it's here. A lot of the meats, a lot of these animals we've read, it's been given to us in a system because the priests love systems and categories, and they're in charge of making these charts. But at the core, if you look at it, a lot of these animals eat dead meat. And so there's some kind of connection to death that they represent, and that's why they're in the bad category.
Same with shellfish.
Shellfish, they're eating junk off the bottom of the ocean. And if you doubt me, just smell a lobster. It's amazing. I had a friend in Boston say that in the early, I don't know if it was 1900s, whenever it was, in the early days, they started giving lobsters to inmates as a cheap source of protein.
Oh my gosh.
So it was like the lowest of the low, and somehow it's flipped up there to be like the symbol of fancy dining. But when I smell a lobster, all I smell is sewer. and yuck. Because it eats sewer. It eats the bottom stuff. So those are the general guiding principle might be that. But Then once you make your categories, you say, hey, all this type of animal is this. So if we give these characteristics, we can basically eliminate all those guys. But then there's a few things that fall in the middle. I'm like, oh, well, what are we going to do with those? And so they get thrown in. They have to go one way or another. And so they get thrown in, like camel.
But the interesting thing is that in
rabbit.
Contemporary Kashrut rulings, it's the split hoof and the chewing the cud issue, which is really the only thing people really know about. All the rest, when you don't, you know, who wants to eat an eagle anyway, sort of thing. But the whole of that first section is sort of written into Judaism very large.
Well, sure, because it's giving you two keys that help you differentiate. When you meet a new meat or a new animal, you can quickly decide whether it's clean or unclean.
Yeah.
It's giving you the principle to make a decision off of, instead of memorizing the whole long list. But then they also give a whole long list just in case, and some of these are exceptional, like the pig, because a pig has a split hoof. But back to what Danny was saying, if you were to choose one thing in your eating, in your menu, that would set you apart as a nation, it was actually very smart to choose the pig as something you don't eat.
Everybody
eats pig everywhere in the world, because a pig is so useful. It can scrounge and get its own food. It can eat anything. And most people think it tastes good. You know, how convenient is that? So you go to Australia, you go to South America, anywhere in the world, and they like pig.
They reproduce fast, too.
They reproduce fast. Yeah. There's all kinds of...
And they're easy to keep domestically.
And so if you were trying to differentiate one people group from everybody else to say, don't eat pig, that does it.
But they have the Muslims.
The Muslims took that as well, so now it's a little less differentiated.
They're like post-Jews.
So they took it from the Jews?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, Islam is from the 6th, 7th century, so Judaism and all its traditions were fully in place by that point, as was Christianity. So many concepts, even martyrdom, can be connected to early Christian martyrs. So Muhammad got to pick and choose from many things.
Even the concept of one God.
Yeah, one God. And he liked the pig rule.
Not wars, like, you call that martyrdom. It's like, well, people die in wars. It's not martyrdom.
It is interesting to note that I would say pig meat has a special emotional status today as the most unclean animal. But really, it's no different than rabbit meat or shellfish or all the other things, camel meat.
Yeah, I was, as you were talking about these meat items, and you think about lobster, I was thinking about the color of meat. Lobster meat, of course, is laban, and that's often the euphemism
of pig meat
today for pig meat.
White meat.
Basar laban.
The other white meat.
They call
not
it.
Chicken.
But just white meat itself isn't really bad. We have chicken that's considered good, and then on the other side, I was.
Although
thinking,
I personally
okay,
think it's bad.
Okay, you have maybe
the dark meat's better than the white.
I shot an Abyssinian hornbill once in Africa, just to see what it was, and.
I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, never mind. It's a great big huge bird. It sort of looks like a forest turkey, only the meat is raunchy. It's like deep dark colored.
Yep.
And it's a scavenger, and so of course we're not going to eat it. But the color of the meat, even though that one would be unclean and it's eating carrion, if you look, the color isn't all that different from goose.
Mm-hmm.
And yet goose is considered clean.
Right.
But
so you can't really differentiate from color.
Some goose can get pretty smelly.
It sure can. Some goose. Show me the goose that isn't smelly. That's what I want.
No, we've worked out on
this. But so according to this scripture, there's really no way to differentiate between the horn-billed Abyssinian hornbill and a goose.
By the color of the meat, but by...
But according to the scripture, there's no way to differentiate from what we're reading in Leviticus, because it's all
the
about...
The goose is clean.
The goose is clean. Well, here's the interesting thing. This is a list of unclean. So the assumption is everything not on this list is clean.
Okay. But they would have
might, because there's a lot of birds that migrate. I'm not an expert on it, but I know.
But a goose is not here either.
Even the dulchifat, which is, you read it, how do you call it, a hoopy?
Yeah, it's like hoopoe, isn't it?
Hoopoe, hoopy, I don't know how to pronounce it in English.
Hoopoe.
It's a funny name in English and Hebrew, I guess.
It's
Israeli bird. And the funny thing about this Israeli bird is it migrates. It leaves in the fall and comes back in at the end of February.
It's a national bird.
It's a national bird,
Well, Perry set that up.
Yeah, the national bird is a migrant. So
it comes back to the death and the life thing.
Yeah, scavengers. And then a couple things that maybe aren't scavengers but resemble other things that are kind of get thrown into the category because you need clean categories and better to be on the safe side. I mean, the priests, they want to keep things in categories to be helpful and they want it to be on the safe side.
Why don't they just say scavenger? Like a catfish. It doesn't have scales and it's a scavenger, so it's unclean. But why don't they just say scavenger?
I don't know.
Maybe they didn't have the word. Maybe they just knew all the different animals. I remember being horrified when I discovered that in another section, it's not here, the ostrich is unclean.
Oh, yeah. It's here.
In this chapter?
Okay, well, here's the problem.
This
on that.
16.
In Hebrew, there's Bat Ye'ana is usually translated ostrich, and your translation might have it translated owl or something else. There's a whole...
I've got it just owl. Yeah. Just an owl. Oh, really? The desert owl is the
Australian.
I've got the desert owl.
The desert owl. That's a big difference.
Let's see. It's at the beginning of the eagle owl.
I got screech owl.
And my in the Net Bible, it says the eagle owl, literally the daughter of the wasteland. That's what it's saying in their note.
The great owl, the white owl, the desert owl.
Various proposals for the species of bird referred to here include owl, horned owl, and ostrich. Mm-hmm. So,
anyway, I remember being horrified when I discovered in another version that it actually said ostrich. Mm-hmm. And it was a friend of mine who ran a very fancy restaurant in town, and I've been eating ostrich. And it's the most wonderful meat you've ever eaten in your life.
It is.
It's
very tasty.
And there are ostrich farms all over Israel, so they don't have pig farms.
Exactly. And that's my point, that the pig has been emotionally elevated to symbolic level. And I think because everywhere else in the world eats pig.
Yeah.
Not everywhere else eats ostrich. Not everywhere else eats shellfish, some of these things. So the pig is like the, what do you call that? The motto?
The epitome of sin.
Yeah, the mascot of kosher or non-kosher.
In Christian Europe, when they were persecuting Jews, the way to make sure that they
were Christian.
Humiliated them or they've really fully converted was to let them see what
made them.
Yeah. Exactly. It had symbolic force for a long time.
Or go to the sandwich counter at any one of the international airports in Europe, and you look, and it's all pink meat.
Yeah.
The whole counter.
Not just Europe.
No.
You go to America, and you might order a chicken dish, and they throw in bacon to make it taste good.
Right.
Or cheese. You know, there's like some way. Oh, my goodness. I went, what's that place called? Cracker Barrel, if you've heard of that. Or bacon grease. It was so hard to just find. Can I just get a cooked vegetable that's not in bacon grease?
In Salamanca, Spain, 30-some years ago, a famous text critic was there. We were having dinner.
You have to speak up a little louder, maybe. It's a
so
good
there
story.
There was an Israeli professor there, and we were at a table in Salamanca ordering dinner, and so the professor, who's not Shomer Mitzvot, still didn't want to eat pig meat, so ordered a trout or a fish, and everybody got their dishes, whatever, and so here comes this fish, and it's really fat, and he's looking at it, and he's going, wow, I've never seen a fish this fat before, and he flipped it, it was cut, he flipped it open, two huge slabs of ham.
It's like, we know you ordered fish, but you couldn't possibly want it without bacon or ham. Impossible,
he
right?
He just took the two slabs, put them to the side, and ate his fish, because he wasn't...
That,
but,
right.
Oh.
Yes, right.
Again, you want to be different, that's a good thing. And I would say the same thing after being in Amsterdam. It's very hard to find something that doesn't have pig meat or pig product in it.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Or the related law that's a tradition is the meat and milk, keeping that separate. Interestingly, let's see if anybody knows this. It's okay if you don't. Where is the other place in the Bible that gives you this list? Does anyone know?
You mean the clean and unclean?
Clean and unclean meats. Deuteronomy.
I think it's chapter 14. And the slight difference that it sets up first, okay, you can eat all of this. It kind of gives you some broad categories. And then these are the meats you can't eat. And it seems like it pretty much copies this list. I'm sure there are little differences you could get into.
That's our favorite verse for making sure you bring extra.
Later. But the interesting thing is at the end of the whole list there, they have another little rule tacked on, and it's don't boil a lamb in its mother's milk.
Yeah, that's weird.
And so they have actually expanded this list to include the other verse that is fundamental to modern kosher practices. And as I was explaining to my students recently, this verse symbolizes how the Jewish thinking works, because you have this little law and you don't fully understand, or you ask yourself all these questions. Well, if I have milk in my house, how do I know that that milk didn't come from the mother whose meat I have? Especially if you're living on your own little farm, because you're going to sacrifice a lamb. Lambs are babies, right? Well, where did that lamb come from? It came from
a mother.
Where's your milk coming from? Chances are a mother who just gave birth and has milk. So what are the chances you're going to be mixing mother's milk with your lamb? Oh no, how do I know for sure to keep them separate? Well, let's be on the safe side. Let's not have any milk with any meat. And so you have this original little verse, and then you have a big old fence around it so that there's no way you're going to break that law. And added to that is the fact that that little law comes 3 times in the Bible. So they ask themselves, what about this law is so important that it comes 3 times? You could say, well, it's just been preserved in the priestly source and in the Deuteronomic source and whatever. But still, it's there 3 times.
It was some sort of Canaanite custom, I think.
Possibly. I mean, that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah. I'm always baffled how a chicken could be boiled in its mother's milk.
Well, here's the problem. So then you have later communities. Now let's say you're in the Middle Ages and you go to the meat market and all the meat is sold together. And like, oh, well, how do I know that that's really chicken? Because it's sold with all this other stuff. And how do I know that chicken didn't touch this other meat? And maybe if it touched it, you know, and so then that's another thing here. And what if it's dark meat chicken and it looks like beef, or vice versa? So now we're going to say chicken is a meat, but fish isn't. Fish is white, right? You can see.
The were bright. You remember growing up there.
Yes.
We had canned cheese that had a picture of a penguin on it. It was called penguin cheese.
Yeah.
And I remember they came to me and they said, now look, that's a bird. This is cheese. Birds don't have cheese.
Yes.
What are you trying to do to us?
Sharon, is one of the references not to boil the kid in its mother's milk having to do with compassion? Like the three.
I think it must have been a very popular dish here, and it could either be related to the compassion, where you have other verses in Deuteronomy where if you come across a nest, you're allowed to take the eggs, but not the mother, so she can lay more eggs, that kind of thing. There's similar laws that you could see maybe a compassion thing in there as well. Or the other theory is that this popular dish was somehow ceremonial in some other religion. Like there was more to that dish that maybe was popular in a idolatrous festival or something. I don't know, and I don't think we have the hard facts to prove it one way or another.
But nevertheless, it's absolutely rigid within most Judaism.
Yeah.
I have a story which I can tell you very quickly. I had a very, very orthodox rabbi come to the house. This is years ago, he's dead now. And I offered them a cup of tea. And he said, what do you use your kettle for? I said, oh, I'm really sorry, Siggy. I forgot to tell you. I boil my pork chops in every morning for breakfast. And his wife said, touche or something. They had their cup of tea. I mean, it becomes ludicrous. It's so ludicrous.
Well, this is why you have in Second Temple Judaism, which is really when they started really cracking down on how to keep these laws, you have a bunch of stone vessels because it was determined that stone could become clean and unclean.
It's like glass now.
Because here, look at this. Like we discussed, you know, your whole pot could get broken.
Yes.
And not just that. If you've been to Katsrin and you see their ovens, they're these clay ovens.
Yeah.
Imagine a dead lizard falls in your oven.
And to break the oven.
Break the whole oven. Yeah. And how much money and time have you lost by breaking that oven?
However, those are porous. Because
yeah.
Pottery is porous, and so the germs would come in. You know, it makes sense.
Okay. A lot of stone is also a little porous.
Yeah.
But
that's
somewhere there's got to be a practical limit, you know.
Technically, you can use glass for meat or milk.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, but
technically
you can.
Yeah.
No, nothing to do with sterilizer. This is nothing to do with cleanliness as such.
Oh.
It's to do
right.
with
although
ceremony.
Although there is that overlap. I'm not denying there isn't that overlap.
Yeah.
And there are reasons why Jews in Europe lived when other people got the plague. They
right.
were cleaning out their whole house, and they were washing things.
Yeah.
And so it did have a hygienic effect. But that was not the driving force, or it's not the only driving force, because it doesn't work for all of it.
It doesn't mean you have to have two washing or dishwashers.
Yeah.
People now have two dishwashers.
Yeah, that's
two fridges.
Go to really quickly. Okay, we're going to read through Isaiah, and I think you're going to find just two words that connect us up.
Grasshopper. Just kidding.
There you go. But if you have a good, healthy understanding of all this stuff, it also helps you when you read the Samson story and he's touching stuff from a carcass.
Right.
You know, or when you read other stories, certain things start to make more sense if you have this world in mind.
But both the Leviticus and the Deuteronomy verse end with, but just be holy because I am holy. Like,
yeah,
even just out of obedience. If for
exactly.
no other reason, I'm set apart, I'm holy.
It's
that's the bottom line. You're supposed to treat the system seriously and follow it because God put it in place. And by doing that, you are holy the way he is holy. And to ignore it and just say, it doesn't really matter, is basically ignoring God. And so even if fundamentally, you know, there's nothing wrong with pig meat or whatever, if you go ahead and eat it, you're basically saying, I don't care what God just said. And then there is something wrong with that. So Isaiah 40:16. Okay. Gemma, do you want to start us?
Lebanon is not enough to burn, or its animals enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. By him they are accounted null and void. To whom then will you liken God? To what likeness will you compare him? To an idol? A craftsman casts it, a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. One too poor for such an offering chooses wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to prepare him an idol that will not totter. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? He sits above the circle of the earth. Its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the skies like a curtain, spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He reduces princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth a confusion. Scarcely are they planted, scarcely are they sown. Scarcely their stem takes root in the earth when he blows on them and they wither, and a storm carries them off as stubble.
To whom will you compare me? Or who is my equal, says the Holy One? Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls them each by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing.
Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel? My way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not grow weary, and his understanding no one can fathom.
He gives power to the weak, and to those who have no might, he increases strength. shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with the wings of like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint.
Okay, so I see four things that can connect us to our parasha. Two are animals. What are they?
Grasshoppers.
Kagav. Mm-hmm.
Eagle.
Which is one of the grasshopper types of animals. I don't know if I'm spelling grasshopper right. And eagles.
But this
Why?
Eagle, you always say that this eagle is a nesher and it's a vulture.
Okay, here's my little beef.
I remember this from before.
Net Bible, okay? This very same translation, when we were reading in Leviticus, what does it translate nesher? Griffin vulture, which is exactly what it is. And then you get to Isaiah, nesher. How does it translate? Eagle.
But I've seen it translated raven, like in the complete Jewish Bible, I think.
Well, I think...
Both of those are unclean, right?
Vulture. Actually, not the grasshopper.
Right, the grasshopper is clean, but as far as the birds, the vulture,
so
the raven...
It's interesting. He's given us a metaphor for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And one is from the clean category, one is from the unclean.
But
God himself is a nesher.
About eating
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
He's talking about the flight of the eagle. That's a big difference.
But
absolutely.
Vultures are considered this yucky thing. And
to us.
To us today, and so you don't want to compare God.
And to the Greeks, because when the Greeks translated this section, they seemed to use a word that meant eagle. So to the Greeks, the eagle was a better bird than the vulture as well. So
it's the bias
started a long time ago.
It's the same thing going on here with like how we can't imagine that something good could be unclean.
Uh-huh.
They can't imagine that this ugly, yucky bird could be.
Yeah.
Could also
and Sarah's point is really important, that it's unclean to eat.
Right.
And in our list it says, this is the clean and unclean, this is what you can eat and what you can't eat. So it doesn't mean it's a bad animal, it's just you can't eat it. And God himself says he is a vulture. So God is holy.
That's right. I gathered him under my wings.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
A vulture.
So he uses this metaphor for himself, and the vulture is an amazing bird. It does have the biggest wingspan. When you look up in the sky, there's a vulture there. It's impressive. You know,
and in Revelation, it says that he's appointed the vultures to eat the flesh of those who do not. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has a designated
there,
purpose.
There you go. That too.
Is that Zakaria?
And of course, one animal can be used in different metaphors, good and bad, based on their qualities. And the vulture is known for its strength. It's known for carrying its young vultures. It's known for building its nest way up high and swooping suddenly.
Is there any difference in the word nesher between an eagle and a vulture at all? I mean, or is it just a generic term for that kind of animal?
For like a bird of prey.
No, there is.
It seems to be a griffin vulture based on all its descriptions, and I believe also cognate languages, if I'm right.
Anyway,
there is a consensus in scholarship, it's griffin vulture.
The eagles take live, they
life
eat live meat,
mm-hmm.
And the vultures eat dead meat. They're different species.
But we had a whole list of birds, if you noticed, that were kite. All this stuff I don't even know in English. You know, kite, raven. What's the difference between a raven and a crow? I can't tell you.
Right.
You know, orev to me is raven. My translation puts crow. I don't even know what the difference is.
Right.
But kite, eagle, different kinds of eagles. And so there were other words for eagle.
Well,
there's a bunch
hawk,
of them.
Eagles and hawks both eat live food. They catch.
Sure.
That whole
But they're all in the unclean category.
But and they're all meat eaters, but those tend to eat live meat. The vulture waits for it to die, and then
mm-hmm.
it comes down. Now there is one thing here, Ya'alu Ever, Mo Evra. Apparently the
tips of the wings, or the tips of the wings, the big feathers, basically.
And Ya'alu Ever Kan Sharim. And so apparently I don't know if they actually do, but the idea is that these birds will regrow their big feathers if they need them.
Well, it's kind of like there are two ways to understand it. You could say Ya'alu Evev, they will go up on their big feathers, or they will sprout big feathers.
Well,
does that verb
back,
be understood
we,
both ways?
What we were saying, what you were saying before about being ceremonially unclean or not. I mean, these animals are, they are ceremonially unclean.
The nesha, yeah.
The nesha. They
the
have this,
clean,
they have this enormous amount of use. They're used every day, whether they're
right.
rescuing people
mm-hmm.
or driving people to the airport. You know what I mean? It's
yeah.
it's the whole unclean thing, and yet you don't eat them.
You don't eat them.
You don't eat
right.
them. You eat things that are
right.
right to eat, or let's put it that way.
Right.
So it's a
yeah.
sort of
arbitrary.
Yeah.
No, it's not arbitrary at all.
It's
the differentiation between.
So what do they call nesher? I mean, it's a positive word, like the taxi service is nesher and everything's nesher.
Yeah, they're fast.
Because nesher is a strong bird.
It's a strong bird.
So it's not considered a vulture in modern Hebrew.
It is a vulture.
It is a vulture.
It just
it
doesn't have as negative a connotation.
Yeah.
Like the,
okay.
It's interesting in Arabic, nesib can mean both eagle or vulture.
Okay.
So they have the same, weird,
yeah.
I don't know why, but.
It's a little bit like this thing about buffet.
Yeah,
you know,
we have
in,
a negative concept
you have
in
a
English.
A concept in English.
And the etu in the Greek
profanity is
also
a bad thing.
Right.
But really, it just means
ordinary
use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Non-holy.
Non-holy.
Yeah.
Not
in,
separated.
In Africa, they have something called a fish eagle. Looks a little bit like the bald eagle of America. And, of course, they tend to be alone, and you'll see them over a river or lake and swoop down and take fish.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to see the vulture, all you need to do is drop a big antelope someplace.
And
it'll come.
And
that's
within,
right.
Literally within minutes.
That's another Bible study.
You, within minutes.
Where the
you
body is,
the
vultures
trees,
gather.
You look around the trees, and they're all lined.
Okay.
The tops of the
okay.
trees will have all the vultures there lined up.
We're out of time, but I want to add two more things that I thought were significant that connect us up. We've seen two little animals in our list that connect these two passages. The other thing I can point to is a more distant connection. But we discuss this word being fundamental to the creation story. And there is other creation words in Isaiah 40. We have the word tohu back in verse 17, which is translated absolutely nothing by the net. This is a word of chaos in the beginning of creation. And so we have some other creation language, and then God himself is called the Holy One here. So there's a couple other verbal connections. And I just think that's significant because in somebody's mind, they have to be so immersed in not only content, but style. The style of certain vocabulary that connects you to themes of creation. In their mind, they can make these little connections kind of intuitively. And so you have tohu, which goes back to creation. You have the Havdil that goes back to Genesis 1 creation. And so that could also be connecting. And this Kodesh, to separate.
It's also as tohu, it's a good German word, you know.
And one other connection too. Sheketz, we didn't talk about. But to defile, Sheketz is a detestable thing. And by eating a bad thing, you are making yourself defile and you should detest these ceremonial unclean animals.
I thought a sheked was an almond. It's the same word.
What's a what?
That's the diet.
Sheked. No, this is sheketz.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
And our passage talked about the sheretz, all the creepy and crawly things. And those two things, well, not this one. This is from our creation account, so that could... Both two things are thinking of creation. But the sheketz is also connected to idols.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have sheketz in its broad definition in your mind as such a theme from reading all these animals in Leviticus, you're going to think also about idols. And that's what Isaiah 40 has, a bunch of idolatry. And so I just want to show you how the mind might be connecting these passages based on both the words themselves and the greater distilled themes or associated concepts, like idolatry and detestable things. And so it's kind of neat to see how those two things can be talking about totally different things, but
good.
Some overlap.
He popped as a hawk shot.
Done with a rock, yeah. Okay. Very halachic.
And anyway, Kohen is now German, and I ran across it in Asterix comics when
that
they
used Tohu Vavohu.
Alles war Tohu Vavohu.
That's because some of the great researchers in the Enlightenment were German, biblical scholars.
I would say took it from Yiddish. But
oh, yeah? Oh, probably. That's a better explanation. So, Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Shabbat Shalom.